Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like art criticism, storytelling and literature, archaeology, and geography. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
We're joined by Hillary Cleary, an interactive designer at IDEUM, who works with her team in Corrales to create, develop, and manufacture multi-touch, immersive, and interactive exhibits for museums across the country. Recent projects can be seen at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, the World War II Museum, and the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame. We're also joined by Ethan Ortega, instructional coordinator for the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs Historic Sites Division, who worked with students at New Mexico Highlands University to reimagine the exhibits at the Jemez Historic Site Visitors Center, which opened to the public in May 18th, 2019. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the impact of immersive exhibits on museum and historic site visitors. We've been talking about all sorts of stuff in some of our other segments. How is this kind of immersive exhibit, this sort of experiential, educational visit, is it going to really have a lasting impact? I kind of get how when we engage all of our senses, when we get away from reading long lengths of text, when we have some kind of emotional engagement with the material, that's going to drive something for me that afternoon. But is there a way to have a lasting impact on the person who experiences this? And if so, is there a way to even measure that?
I think it goes back a little bit about what we were talking about previously, you know, with the exhibit that we developed for the World War II Museum for Bob Hope's USO tours. I was pretty active in creating a lot of the content for that. So sourcing the media, the images and video, and then also writing the copy that we did have. That was the first time that information had surfaced really since those tours. So I was working directly with some of his family members and also a curator at the World War II Museum. And we really brought these things to life, just sort of trying to decipher his journals and
Bob Hope, you mean?
Yeah. And so, you know, they just have this wealth of content really that is getting lost. It has the potential to bring a lot of history and culture to the forefront and also preserve it in ways that, you know, after a certain amount of time, those journals may not exist anymore. And hopefully what we've created will persist both in the visitors' minds who've seen our exhibits, but also just for the sake of, you know, history and historiography. These digital and immersive spaces can be really powerful tools for uncovering new perspectives to the narrative of history.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people are more likely to share experiences that they had that were really impactful. So whether it's, you know, from immersion or just something that really struck a chord with them. You know, we have this really, really old portion of the Coronado Historic Site Museum exhibit that we've left because it's these replicas of Coronado's armor that was like made in the 1950s. We get people coming in, you know, that are in their 70s and are like, I remember trying this on when I was a kid and my kids have tried it on and their grandkids have tried it on. And so now we brought our great grandkids to try it on. And so, you know, that kind of stuff can really be impactful to people. And we're starting to see that with some of our digital initiatives as well. So a project that we did at Coronado maybe 3 years ago was a physical digital immersive environment. And so we used an HP Sprout and we had 3D printed portions of the ancient village of Kowawa. And as you build the village on the mat, it starts to project on the top of it and people start to climb out of the building. And they start to interact with their environment with AI. So they start fishing and, you know, you can add crops and animals and they start interacting with that. And so, like I said, it's been on display for a few years and it had a malfunction a couple weeks ago. And so it was down for a few weeks. And then we started getting visitors that were bringing people in specifically to see that. Yeah. And so, you know, I was really surprised because I knew it was really cool, but I didn't realize like how impactful it was. And so we worked really hard, and within a couple of weeks, we had a replacement for it.
So it's almost like a tactile Minecraft kind of. I mean, like but based on an actual interpretive model.
Yeah, based on archaeological and also like like, you know, oral history information. But it turned out to be a fantastic interpretive tool because we designed it like with children in mind, but it really became popular like with elderly people. I was really surprised because of some of the layers of content that were in it. And then also our visitors with like learning disabilities, because of the tactile nature, it was a really, really great opportunity for them too.
Maybe it's the maker in me, but that really appeals to me, the idea that you could build something physical that is also has these layers put on top of it and is reacting to what you're building and delivering the educational message at the same time, I guess.
And like I said, there's multiple layers. So, you know, like kid that's not super interested but wants to build something can do it and get something out of it visually. But then, you know, an adult that wants to dig deeper, there's other layers. So there's other screens that have information popping up with everything that you do physically.
Whose idea was that?
So that was actually another project with Highlands University, which started out on an iPad 5 years ago and went from a capacitive touch kind of application to this, that when the HP Sprout came out, we took advantage of those cameras on top. So now
an HP Sprout?
Yeah, so you can kind of imagine it as like a regular desktop computer, except it's a touchscreen. And then where the keyboard should be is another touchscreen, but it's a projection on a touch mat. And so there's also cameras where the projector hangs over so that you can put an object on there, create 3D models from that touchpad, and then use the cameras to visually identify objects that are on it as well.
To me, and this is more me as a layperson, what I always find just so awesome is when I can actually contribute to the exhibit itself. With these immersive technologies, it seems like there's also more opportunity, not just for people telling their stories, but maybe for, I don't know if crowdsourcing is the word, but could you sort of crowdsource interpretation, or are things more tightly curated?
Are you talking about like the narrative?
Yeah.
I see that the narrative is becoming much more open as museums move along. And so, yeah, I think that all of this digital media will allow people to have more of an input. That kind of, you know, brings up two thoughts in my head. One is archaeology in the States is legally protected. There's a few countries out there that have made that information open. And I'm not advocating for us to do that here, because here in New Mexico alone, we have 200,000 identified archaeological sites. And, you know, by keeping them secret, it helps keep them protected and preserved. But in the countries that have allowed that information to be open source, the layperson has started to notice patterns that archaeologists have missed by looking at that kind of information. And I think with collections and with history, the same thing could happen. Absolutely.
The IDEAM exhibits probably have ways for people to, I don't know, what, take their own pictures and insert them into the...
I mean, definitely something that's becoming more prominent. And I think the Cowgirl project was actually sort of the ethos behind that was sort of visitor participation. So in working with those curators, they had a series or sets of different collection items. So those are cowgirl boots, famous cowgirls, sort of jackets, or all clothing and material based. And so we took those essentially and then created digital designs out of them. So the way the exhibit works is there's two stations on either end of a touchscreen table, and visitors can work to essentially collaboratively create a scene together on the projection. So the elements that you have in your design, each visitor is designing an object that's inspired by these collections, is your own. It's a custom design. But then it also contributes to essentially a living, breathing wallpaper around the room that's animated and moving. And so you're working with another person to create something that is your own, but it's also grounded in the history of the National Cowgirl Museum and their collections.
Is there also a chance here to blur the line between fact and fiction?
I mean, between author and audience.
Or between author and audience. I mean, at a certain point, is there a danger in these sorts of exhibits or experiences?
If people are going to learn something real about something, and they go in and there's a dinosaur exhibit that's a bunch of kids' origami dinosaur prancing around, what does that do to their sense of, I'm here in a museum learning about real stuff?
there's different levels of interpretation, and that's something that we really tried to work hard to achieve in the Cowgirl exhibit, for example. So you can have this experience if you want just a surface level of observing this beautiful wallpaper scene. You're not really getting any context. But if you're actually participating in the application, there's lots of ways to learn about this specific collection items. So if you are working on designing a boot and you really like the flower pattern that you're using, we have built in those interpretive elements so you can click on like learn more, and we have all of their collection information and text and images about the collections. I suppose there is a danger of someone just coming in and observing something and not really having context for it, but in my mind, that's possible anyway. You know, like you can enter a museum space and not learn anything. It's all about how much you want to participate. So at least by pulling someone in and trying to engage them and engage their senses, we've, in a sense, captured their attention, which hopefully leads to more in-depth and meaningful discussions about what it is that they're observing.
Well, I think it's also a question of curating, which in a sense is designing the experience, which is really what both of you are doing for a living, which is to ensure that things are guided or stay on track, even if it can get a little wild and woolly at the edges.
Yes, it's interesting. We had those conversations early on for the Cowgirl project because we were thinking initially that people could design whatever they wanted to put it on the boot. And then, you know, we sort of stepped back and we were like, well, does that really relate to the collection as much? And also, people do have a tendency to write profane things and contribute things that aren't necessarily educationally meaningful. So finding that balance of how much can people contribute in a way that still is true to the information in the collection and facilitates learning.
I'm also curious, given that you both are doing these immersive exhibits and experiences that can have all these different aspects to them, are there big differences in terms of how you might approach these depending on the audience? I know that you had talked, Hillary, about the World War II exhibit might just attract older people. Are there ways you can go about making it accessible and engaging for really, really diverse audience, or is that just kind of hit or miss? Or
I think the use of all of this allows it to be more accessible. That might mean to diverse audiences, or it might mean to audiences that wouldn't normally have the chance to experience some of these histories. You know, I mentioned earlier the like VR stuff that we're doing with schools. There's a lot of schools that don't have the resources to come to our historic sites. By putting that stuff online or taking it to the classroom, it does provide it to a group of people that wouldn't get to see it. And depending on what that content is, you know, it may be something that, oh, it's just a place that they've never been, or it could be a whole culture that they've never experienced before.
I never thought of designing for absent audiences.
I work for the state of New Mexico. I'm a public servant, so I serve the people of New Mexico, and there's some school districts that have considered most of our sites out of their district, and teachers have to pay extra fees per students to bring them out. And so, you know, that really has changed our game in the last 2 to 3 years. We're kind of embracing this stuff, which is more accessible, these technologies, emergent things that are coming out, and trying to harness them in a way that we can reach our audience and serve them.
When you bring these, say, traveling exhibits, is it a very different kind of exhibit if you know you're bringing it into a classroom of young people versus a senior citizen center or something?
Yeah, definitely. We do like adjust. I think that younger groups are much more open to new technologies. The older groups are definitely interested, but you might have to ease them into it a little bit.
I think our intention a lot of the times is to have a demographic that we're working specifically with. We've been working on a project for the Indianapolis Children's Museum about ancient Greece and doing projection mapping for that. But our hope is that, you know, we're serving a primary audience, and then in doing that, you're allowing other demographics to enter the picture, right? I mean, most children are going to be coming there either with their school groups or with their parents or grandparents or whoever it is. And by having different age groups interact with something together, you make the people maybe who are more hesitant to participate more comfortable. And what we found also is that if someone is using an exhibit already, then, you know, maybe someone who's a little more reticent will come up and watch them, and then that's their sort of window or gateway into using it themselves.
I'll show you how to do it, Grandpa.
We've totally experienced that too. Like I said, with the immersive Build Your Own Pueblo program, we call it Sim Pueblo.
I love it.
Also with the Hay Mess exhibit and the projection mapping that we've done, I had a few older women women that were at the exhibit opening that came up to me outside, and they were like, that was my grandma in there.
Yeah,
my grandma was like life size, you know, on the wall from a historic photo, which is pretty amazing.
Oh, that is. That's fantastic.
That's awesome.
For more information about the Jemez Historic Site, visit nmhistoricsites.org/Jemez online. For more information about IDEUM and their immersive exhibits, their touchscreen and tactile exhibits, you can visit IDEUM.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, string bassist and loopmeister extraordinaire.